Welcome to our sixth talk in the series of seven talks and 14 classes on the seven factors of enlightenment. And tonight we are looking at the factor of samadhi. Now, and I have to be careful as we approach this particular subject because we hold a lot of mystique around this word, I would say, as we watched Ajahn Sumedho last week and recognized his genuineness and authenticity after, I don't know how many, 40 years or so of being a monk. As I was leaving, I heard two people speaking, and one said to the other, "I'll never have that kind of samadhi." And I think we undervalue what we have or how we receive it, what this subject is about. It's obviously very important because you see it all over the map of the Buddhist literature. It's in the five spiritual faculties, in the Eightfold Path, and now in the seven factors of enlightenment. So it's obviously an important subject, but we have to be careful that we don't make too much of it. We demystify it. We make it approachable so that we can get our arms around it. And so tonight I want to explore this topic and see how we can arouse the energy for samadhi, to see whether we are using our lives with the intention of what that word indicates, and just exactly what the value of prolonged sitting or retreating is in relationship to this word. Because I think we need to come to terms with this and be honest with ourselves, whether we're practicing enlightenment with this factor or not. And I was actually pretty amazed. A few weeks ago, we had a retreat out at Cloud Mountain, and a number of you attended. And some of you who attended from this class hadn't had much, if any, retreat experience before. And there are a whole number of people who came from not from this area, but from different states, who had more retreat than people from this class. And yet, I didn't feel, and this is, I don't mean this to be categorical, but in general, I felt a maturity level from the people who had had and been coming regularly to SIMS, as opposed to the group of people who had had more retreat experience and hadn't had access to an ongoing week like this. And so I was actually, I felt somehow rewarded in how we are spending our time. There was no question that I think there was a clearer intention in general, with people who had had this weekly class and a deeper level of understanding and clarity as to what the path was about. All very significant in our progress, in our growth in this tradition. The one quality, component, that may need a little strengthening, I felt, from those people was the quality of samadhi. And so let's look and see what we mean by that and see how retreating can certainly supplement our strength in that area. First of all, samadhi, I clearly differentiate between that and concentration, and I'll talk more about that later in the talk. A mind can have a razor-sharp focus, which is concentration on one particular object. But samadhi is something different than that. Samadhi is what I call stability of mind, mental harmony, oneness of mind. It's the mind that, when you look into somebody's eyes, it's not being shaken. It's not, you can see the eyes aren't flitting around in guesswork, moving from thought to thought. And from that point of view, I can certainly understand why people were impressed with Ajahn Sumedho's samadhi level, because he's like a rock, isn't he? I always feel like I just contacted a piece of granite. And you could see that it would take that sort of stability and rootedness to do what he has done, which is establish the Western monastic tradition outside Eastern countries. But what is this thing of samadhi, and why is it given such mystical proportions? Well, I think for one thing, this is just me speaking now. This is just my own opinion. But during the Buddha's time, most of the monks, if not all of the monks that he was associated with prior to his own awakening, were monks that were developing deeper and deeper levels of concentration states, absorption states into the jhanas. And the Buddhist literature is filled with the Buddha teaching people from and around these jhana states. Now, why would he do that if those jhana states weren't important to a person's practice? Well, what I think is because that was the given. Almost every monk there had prolonged practice in the jhanas, the absorption states, concentration states, and the Buddha wasn't going to negate all that and say that's all hogwash, we're going to do something else entirely. He wasn't going to dismiss somebody's monastic career. He was going to build on top of that. He was going to take what the strength they already had and then move it in a different direction. And so I think that's the reason there's so much emphasis in the suttas on these absorptions, these great states of concentration. But I think the Buddha, when he was pointing away from the absorption states, he was touching something else. He was touching not the focused concentration, which, believe me, has its allure because of the qualities of mind that arise within those states are enchanting. They're the siren's call. And it's hard for anyone without a great deal of understanding of what the value and purpose of the practice is, not to be lured away from a kind of a, what is this freedom anyway? Here's something I can really get my hands around, this bliss, this enjoyment, this calm, this quiet. And freedom sounds too uncertain at best and kind of unapproachable to many of us. But here's a state that I can really, in my absorption, I can really feel the value of what my mind offers me. And so it's very luring. There's a deep tendency in many of us to cash in on the level of that kind of absorption. But the Buddha was pointing, he was pointing to insight. He was pointing to learning. He was pointing not to hiding out in some cave of the mind, but what learning takes place when aliveness, when we're interfacing with our life on an ongoing basis, and understanding this sense of me being separate from. Now, you can't do that in absorption states. Does this sense of absorption help the sense of samadhi? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But I think it's important to understand what we're really talking about, two different things when we're talking about absorption states and concentration and samadhi, which is what the Buddha was talking about, this oneness of mind, this mental stability, this unshakable quality in one that is not lost within the distraction of thought. That is essentially what a samadhi mind is like. It doesn't get lost on every little flit of thought that comes through it. It holds itself steady because it's no longer giving itself away to thought. It has seen through the need to think ourselves through life. And so there's a lot of wisdom or understanding that is embedded within samadhi. In fact, samadhi is a function of understanding itself, not a function of a forced effort, which concentration ultimately is that sense of driving our attention, focusing our attention at the at one particular point and object to everything else that might be arising. That's a hell of a muscle that you can develop in that. And in fact, it can be so strong that, and this is another lure that is there, is that you can develop psychic powers. Watch. No, thank God I didn't do that. I didn't go that way. But just to give you a moment of, I was obviously, when you practice as long as I did and for the length of time I did, you have a great deal of concentration as well as samadhi. And I had just disrobed and I was in Rishikesh in India. And I was being housed at this yoga ashram with another Westerner. And I had one pair of clothes and this Westerner had a whole closet full. And so he had come in and left, and I was looking at his closet, and I say, I'm going to will that guy to give me that shirt. There's just one shirt out of maybe 15 shirts that he had. I said, I want that shirt. So he came back in, he looks at me, he goes right to the closet, he takes out that shirt and offers it to me. And I never did that again. It scared the bejeebers out of me. I don't want that kind of power. I don't want anything to do with that. But you could see how if I had a different tendency or a different need, that could be trained as such. I'm long past the ability to do that because as you become more and more active in the world, you lose that crisp edge of concentration. But it can be done. And I in no way doubt that some of these saints, including Christ, did all the miracles that they claim. There's nothing inherently that negates any of Buddhism in those miracles. In fact, at one point the monks were performing kind of miracles at the time of the Buddha, and the Buddhists called them together and said, look, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not in the show business. And so don't do it. Don't do it. And so he made that a rule, the monastic rule, that you don't show off with your powers. So, but again, there's a lot that gets stirred up in terms of one's neediness or in terms of one's sense of power as we move more and more into the field of concentration. Not only the fact that it feels good at times to concentrate at more and more subtle levels, but that other things arise as well that can be used to abuse the relationship of self and other. So now we're looking at this sixth factor of enlightenment, and we want to understand wise samadhi, samadhi that is sufficient to do what we need to gain access to insight and understanding and awareness. And I love the way these factors are built upon one another, that they're not just seven different products that have been kind of thrown in and in the closet somewhere, but rather, again, using the analogy of the soup, these are flavors within this particular stew that we're boiling. And each flavor augments and complements the next. In fact, it's hard to differentiate the different flavors, although you can get a slight sense of one flavor as opposed to another. They really build upon each other. And that is the way these factors work. For instance, now remember that we're talking about stability of mind. Stability of mind, the mind that's able to hold a focus. What do you need in order to hold a focus? Well, you need not to be so busy, right? Busyness is in contradiction. I mean mental busyness. And some people can be physically busy but not be mentally busy, and other people can be be very sedate in their life, but be very mentally busy. So those two don't necessarily coordinate with one another. But busyness in general, mental busyness, is a deterrent to any kind of spiritual growth at all. It's kind of reckless chaos. And most of our minds, when we look at it, contain a quality of that recklessness, that sort of out of control, helter-skelter, where we're flitting from one idea to the next. There's anything that passes in front of us catches our attention and we're off in that direction. And that's not very helpful. So the different qualities, these beautiful qualities that are engendered in insight training, mindfulness, that ability to know what's arising as opposed to the thought about what's arising, to know directly what's arising. You see, just listen to each of these qualities in terms of its stabilizing factor upon the mind as a whole, because each of these factors build upon the factor of samadhi. Just listen to them from that point of view, from that perspective. So you have mindfulness that holds the object without, and knows the differentiation between the direct contact and the thought about that particular object. Then you have an investigative response, a curiosity, something that won't take the surface tension of how we hold something to be the truth. It looks curiously for what's underneath it. What does this, is there something I'm missing here? It looks for a more complete and uniform application of awareness. And then you have this joyful interest, which we talked about in terms of rapture. This interest that when you're focused on something and you're real interested in it, not pretentiously, but genuinely interested upon something, gardening or whatever it might be, the mind is still. It's really trying to absorb the field of its interest. And so you can see how rapture is a quality of samadhi. And then, last week we talked about, or 2 weeks ago we talked about calm. And that quality of experience that is unruffled and sort of seamlessly smooth. So that things from that kind of the calmness of the ocean, wavelessness, you begin also to see how that quality can fit into the overall perspective of samadhi. So each of those things builds upon this sense of stability of mind, mental harmony, oneness of mind. The non-moving mind, the mind that can't be fooled by thought. If you want to work towards building that frame of reference, one of the things that I think is very important is to know the difference between thinking and that direct, immediate contact that is so vital to awareness. And many of us are still in the process of learning the difference between those two. We still believe our life is more valuable through thinking than it is through direct contact. The awareness of. So we have to look at the value and the limitation of a life lived in thinking. Because when we throw our energetic force to thinking, we're going to find busyness as the product of that energy. The mind doesn't want to slow down because that's counter to its wishes. It wants to build up more and more juice in its thinking. And so the more active you are, the more engaged you are mentally, the more ruckus the mind is in terms of ideas and thoughts and all that sort of thing, the more on top of the pinnacle of the thinking mind you seem to be. So what's the limitation of that? Well, the limitation of that is the lack of self-knowledge, really. You may have a gay time on that pinnacle, but it's not really showing you too much about who you are and what you are and what the world is. And may I say that that's the whole basis on which spirituality proceeds, journeys through self-knowledge. So this sense of stability of mind, this inner quality, the sixth factor of enlightenment, is a very important one indeed. Because when our mind is stable and unmoving, it begins to cut deeply into the issues at hand, because what it took to be truth at one point, which was what the thinking mind said was true, when it's making direct contact, it no longer takes that to be true. And it becomes curious about what is true now. If this is no longer true, I can see through the projection of what thought told me life was. Now, what is true? So you see that, you hear the curiosity coming out and the interest coming. Wow, this is my life. We better be interested in it. This isn't just some casual thing we're trying to understand here. This is our life. The problem, I think, also is that we're not so interested. We're interested in our life being enjoyable. We're interested in our life being distractible. We're not really interested. We're interested in the pleasures that life offers. Not so many of us are genuinely interested in life for itself. We're interested in what life can give us. But what about life itself? What is this thing called life? That, to me, is where the interest begins to come through a samadhi mind. Because a samadhi mind is no longer chasing after the pleasant and the unpleasant, or avoiding the unpleasant, but is now on top of the subject, as the subject. What is this thing? Who am I? What is this all about? Is this true? Questions that don't generate more distraction, but questions that take you away from thinking towards deeper sense of quietude, so I can see even further and more subtly what is at hand here. What is this awareness showing me about what life is? Now, let me talk about two types of focus. Two types. Because now I want to bring back the differentiation between concentration and samadhi. And I think it's a very important distinction to make. And if you practice with other teachers, they'll have different distinctions. So these are mine, but they're based upon my practice and my understanding. There has to be a differentiation between concentration and samadhi. One-pointed, when we focus in on our breath or the pain in our knee, or we isolate out one particular object and focus exclusively on that particular event, then we are building one-pointed concentration. One-pointed focus, one-pointed concentration. The values of that are very significant. They begin to show you, first of all, they begin to stabilize the mind, and so that you can sustain your attention upon an object for longer and longer periods of time. They begin to show you the difference between thinking about something and making direct contact with it, thinking about the breath and actually directly experiencing the breath. They also begin to show you, through that direct contact, one thing at a time, that whatever it is that we're focusing on has the same characteristics of everything else, that it changes, that is essentially harmless in nature, and that there's no sense of the mind makes, it's of the mind's making. There's nothing inherently there. And so that's very important. And we spend a long time in our practice, especially early on, focusing in one-pointedly on everything that's happening. We go from our breath to the pain in our knee, to our emotion, to our physical sensation, and back to the breath, or whatever carousel we get on. Eventually, we stay with one thing and one thing only. And much of Dharma practice is built upon that. Now, that's one-pointed concentration. At some point in the practice, it becomes possible to do what we call moment-to-moment focus. Moment-to-moment focus is what I call samadhi. And the example that was given to me when I was a student, and I still think it's the best example around, is of someone standing on a street corner. And one-pointed focus is noticing each individual car as it's passing the corner. Buick, Cadillac, Chevrolet, whatever. Moment-to-moment focus is standing on the corner, opening the gaze, and not following each individual vehicle, but seeing the panorama of all the vehicles as they pass in front of your eyes. So the gaze is steady, which it wasn't in the first. And in that way, you see all the different vehicles that are passing. That's the difference. In one sense, the mind is steady, and it sees all the different events that are arising within the fabric of the mind. That's samadhi. On the other, it's focusing on one event exclusively, and that's concentration. So, is there time to do but one and not the other? Yes. If you have a certain fear in your mind of an emotion, say your anger is very upsetting to you and you just don't understand it, then you need to spend a lot of time one-pointedly on anger to see what and if it is as fearful as you project it to be. Maybe it's not, but you're never going to find that out unless we make direct contact with it in a sustained way for some period of time, in which it can then prove the fact that it is harmless. That anger doesn't, we need not be fearful of anger. We need not be fearful of loneliness or depression or grief or sadness or any of the other aspects of mind. And so we do that through the ability to focus and pay and concentrate and pay attention upon something. But once we have looked at the variety and variety along the landscape of the mind, we can get very settled back now and say, okay, I've seen it all now. You know, I don't have to keep going, okay, breath, pain in the knee, fear, you know, I can relax a little bit with this thing. I can relax a little bit. Now, samadhi is directly proportional to your ability to relax. Right? And you will find the more you start relaxing with your inward world, the more your inward world holds a steady gaze. Because the art of relaxation means that you're no longer fearful of something, of what's in there. And the fear is what kept the mind moving for its own sense of safety and defense, and thereby kept the mind anything but steady, kept it aroused, kept it distracted. I don't want to see this in me. It's too fearful, so I'm going to go out here and entertain myself. But as we learn the art of relaxing mentally, softening the mind, relaxing the body, we become more at home in ourselves, less need to do anything about anything. We acknowledge the fact that different things are arising, as you acknowledge the fact that different vehicles are passing in front of the corner, but we don't have to do anything. None of them need an oil job. Everything is just passing in front of the corner, and I can relax a little bit with it. Now that sense of steady gaze begins to become important. Notice, though, that one fed the other. That one-pointed concentration feeds the ability for the arising of samadhi. That you're not wasting your time focusing in on your breath or the pain in your knee. You're not wasting your time at all. In fact, I spent a long period of time in my training because I was so self-driven, which a concentration, because it doesn't have a complete understanding, is self-driven. I need this. It can be. There are lots of motivations, most of not seen, for reasons to deepen our concentration. But I also noticed that proportional to the work I was doing on that, the gaze started becoming steadier and steadier. Why? Just for the reason I gave, that as you concentrate more and more, things begin to take their own shape of harmlessness as you approach them. And so there isn't a fear that's instilled with an unknowing about of these events. With the knowing, the self-knowledge that of what's in front of us here is safe, and that sense of relaxation around the safety, then the mind becomes steady. So one-pointed concentration, this is an important point, feeds moment-to-moment concentration. This moment-to-moment focus, which I call samadhi, is really what some teachers have called choiceless awareness, where you're no longer selecting out different aspects to focus upon, but rather there is a choicelessness within that observation. And it's a little bit like, having something right up against your eyes because you're so afraid that it's going to hurt you that you have to keep the gaze up. And then at some point you can relax around it. It fits back in the panorama of all events and all of the things that are around it and beside it and coming through different parts of the mind and body are also seen, like a fireworks display. So how do we nurture these different components? This is really the meat of the talk. All right? I don't think there's any question that one of the easiest ways to nurture one-pointed concentration is through a daily sitting practice and regular retreating. I don't think there's any question about that. When you get into specialized environments like you induce when you're at home without and sitting, or when you go away for a residential or non-residential retreat, and it's a very refined environment. It's a simulation of life without the distractibility. So you aren't being caught off in terms of entertainment, in terms of your busyness. Hopefully you've set your cell phones aside, you've set your life aside, and you enter this environment and with the intention. And the intention, you're there, it's boring to do nothing, so you might as well get on and just start focusing in on follow the instructions. And what you find is that it works. And it's very, very helpful to go on retreats. I hope you're all listening. I'm reluctant to say it's essential, but because some of you don't have access to it, but it's very, very helpful for that one-pointed concentration. But we're after samadhi, remember. Even though one-pointed concentration feeds and supports samadhi, samadhi can be fed and supported without it. Therein lies the lay practice. Therein lies the motherhood, the fatherhood, the worldly worker who doesn't have access to the retreats. What is important for that quality to arise? It takes just as much sincerity. You have to use your life. I think this thing starts with sincerity. In the old metaphor I was using, the pot, the boiling soup, the fire under the boiling soup is your sincerity. It takes you to be sincere about your life, to really ask important questions about it, because the asking of those questions and your interest that is aroused from that asking is samadhi building. And that's why I think that the most important homework that I give you is those questions that almost every sheet contains, that you look at your life from a sense of interest, not from a sense of scorn or any kind of negating dismissal at all. We're not trying to get over our life. We're trying to understand it. And the homework is the key to entering a questioning about your life. It doesn't have to come just through the homework. It can come through your own question, which is much better than my question, your question for yourself. But that sense of questioning, that sense in which you are in wonder of what this thing really is about, I think that's the essential lay practice for samadhi to develop. Let me give you an example. I was watching an interview with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who I'd heard previously said she never meditated. Didn't want to ever do that stuff. It was too, just wasn't the right fit for her. But then I was watching her have an interview with somebody who was dying. And the woman was absolutely present with this dying patient. There was not even a moment in which that contact wasn't intimate and precious for both people. You could see that her mind was interested, it was stable, it was totally present, it was calm. You could just go down every one of the factors of enlightenment, including samadhi, and you could see that that mind was instilled with those qualities. And here's somebody who had never sat or never done a retreat, but whose mind was focused on something to her that was more important than anything, and that was the subject of death and dying. Now, each of us have access somewhere along the line to something that's vitally important to us. It's a root interest, a root interest that each of us have. And I don't know the door how to access that for you. But I know that quite likely you've already rubbed up against it in your life, through your hobbies, through your work, through something. But along the way, what happens is that you've become sidetracked with the inducements, just in the same way as a monk can be induced with the focused concentration in terms of its alluring states of quiet and calm and the caves of the mind, so can the worldly person be induced to the side benefits of fame and money and prestige and distractibility and entertainment that is all out there that we can make our life all about if we want to. If you want to make your life about that, that's what almost every single person on this face of the earth is doing. You just follow suit. But it won't be spiritually fulfilling. And we have to find our way into the questioning that resonates with our interest at that level. Now, the interest isn't an interest in pleasure, like, you know, how can I make more money? I'm really interested in making money. That's not going to ever take you to a spiritual sense of fulfillment. It has to be about life itself. It has to be not about how to distract myself from my life or how to seek an alternative to my life, but what is this life about? And I think the door that allows us each to do that in some way or other is the door of our pain. The very thing that we think is the thing we would be least likely to be interested in is actually a gateway into samadhi and all the other factors of enlightenment. An examination of our pain. And the first thing we have to understand is that the pain that we have is self-inflicted, because we will never abide with any sense of being serious about the pain. We'll never take the pain seriously if we think it's coming from the outside. We have to see that we're doing it ourselves. And so much of Buddhism is to get you on that home plate, is to show you that, in fact, we're miserable because we're making ourselves miserable. Now, when you realize that through insight, not through being coerced into that point of view, when you realize that because you've seen it through a variety of different ways, and that's what we've been talking about here for however many years we've been doing this, then you get excited. You get interested in it. My God, what have I... It's that. It's a slap on the forehead. It's, hello? And then we wake up to this life of ours. And we ask questions which are meant to see how it is that we're holding the world to induce that pain. And that's samadhi. And your interest will be there. We just haven't, if it isn't there yet, we haven't found the door yet. Hang in there, maybe in the next series. We haven't found your door yet through which that interest can be nurtured and sustained. And if you find it, stay there. Don't go to the next series. Use that as your route through all the series. Never pick up another homework sheet if you're really interested in something from 2 months ago's homework and it's still resonating, and you stay with it. We're not trying to make you well learned in homework. We're trying to get your access, your interest. See this? Now that can be done anywhere. Yes, it's helpful if you go on retreat and build a certain level of focus, because that level of focus will often take you quicker to those places where you're in pain and show you more dramatically that you're causing that pain. But it doesn't have to be done through that route. It can be done through your life and your sincerity about your life to understand what your life is. And I wouldn't be sitting here teaching lay practitioners unless I knew that that was possible. And which I was rewarded in this last retreat in seeing that people were, in fact, doing it on their Tuesday nights. Which I don't know, because I'm sitting up here, you're sitting there. I don't know what's going on in you. Now, samadhi has a built-in wisdom. Samadhi, as I mentioned, has built-in wisdom. Concentration does not. Concentration, the thief that's at the cracking the safe is very concentrated. But his ethical motivation is questionable. When somebody, so you can be concentrated and be evil. But you can't have samadhi. Because samadhi shows you the whole of the mind. It shows you your motivation. It shows you everything. And it's based on interconnection. The quiet mind is a connected mind. A connected mind is an ethical mind. An ethical mind is a mind that doesn't betray what it sees. And so there is a beauty in focusing in and encouraging and accentuating the samadhi factor. But when you reach a certain point of concentration, get off that. Get over to samadhi now. You can stay there forever, I'm telling you, and I've seen people do it. They get dragged down into these terrifically sublime states of mind because that's really what they wanted. They wanted to be soothed. So to know the traps of concentration, to know the value of concentration, to know what samadhi is in differentiation to concentration, to know the value of samadhi and being able to hold the mind stable and being able to access that curiosity, which is another factor, that investigation, that interest, to be able to build your life around a certain root question that you have, and to use your life to resolve, to decode that problem from every interaction that takes place. That becomes the mission. That becomes the intentionality. That becomes the reason for your life. Most of us aren't there. That's okay. Just do the minimal, sitting and some of the homework and offering yourself time and time again to look at where it is that you're hurting, and it will evolve that way. So I hope this talk, you feel included no matter where you are in the whole range of your practice. If you're just beginning, fine. Focus in on the breath. Just allow yourself some respite time where you can stabilize your mind and begin to see. And then let the seeing unfold from there. Because the seeing does unfold. And the mind's interest begins to blossom unlike anything you can imagine. Where at the moment there is any indication of discord, inward discord, you're on top of it. Not from aversion, but from interest. Whoa, what's going on here? What is this? And then it's set straight. That stability, that factor that catches a butterfly landing on your shoulder, that can feel the imprint of the slightest touch of life, and to know whether there's any problem that's occurring from that touch. Therein lies a stable mind. Therein lies the sixth factor. Thank you. So if we could sit for a moment or two. So if there are any questions that anyone has, that I'd be happy to speak to them. Yes.
So I'm getting what you said about an inward place. Can this be practiced visually? Like, for instance, if I go to a Mariners game.
Go to a what?
Mariners game.
Mariners game. I don't know whether you can do it or not. There's nothing inherent about a Mariners game except why you're going that would throw you off. If you're going for the entertainment, for the arousal of enjoyment, for the pleasure of it, quite likely you're not going to be interested in doing that. You're going to be interested in what's happening on the field and the details of the field, not the details of your life.
That would seem more interesting to me.
It would, but you have to ask yourself why you would choose a baseball field.
I just throw that out.
Yeah. It can be done anywhere. Listen to my answer. It can be done anywhere. It's the motivation of why you're going that's going to undermine whether you can do it or not. You see? People used to say, well, can I meditate listening to music? I said, well, I don't know. Why are you listening to music instead of following your breath? Well, it's more pleasant. I said, well, that's going to throw you off then. Because if you select out for entertainment purposes, then that's what you're really wanting. You're not wanting to notice what's happening clearly. You're wanting to be entertained. And those are two very different motivations that will throw you off kilter, you see? So can it be done? Of course it can be done. Nothing, there's no experience that one can't use in alignment with your spiritual growth. But will you do it? I don't know. I mean, it just depends. Yes. Yes.
But on the other hand, concentration could help us to open out more.
Yes. Yes.
So at what point do we know whether we're using concentration?
Yes. Yes, a very good question, yes. What point do you know that you're using concentration for unhealthy purposes or for its alignment with your spiritual growth? No one can tell you that. This is where sincerity comes. It really comes back to that. Because people can hide out for various reasons. As I have mentioned before, I do this retreat in September, usually right after a Lee Brazington jhana retreat at Cloud Mountain. And some of the participants from the one come into my retreat. And they all claim that what they really want is insight. But can I get them out of jhana? No. Almost to the person, I can't get them to put down their concentration to join us in insight training. They give me excuses after excuses after excuses on why they're not ready to do that yet. So it's a little bit like yes butting someone. You get a feeling after a while that they don't really want to go. And it's not up to me to try to jerk them out of that. It's up to them to be honest enough to what they really want. And if I knew what they really wanted, I would send them into that. I would say, okay, you go look at that sublime state. You feel it totally. Just open yourself up to feel like you're swimming in the best bliss you ever felt. Just grab it and just nourish yourself in it. Now, how long does it last? Right? Can you abide there? Which means you can experience it, but can you abide in it? See, the isness of your being, it's an experience that you're having, very nice, very enjoyable. But it's not, experience doesn't mean anything, really. So that's what I would do, but because they're trying to hide their truth from themselves, they often aren't honest enough to tell me what they really want. So even at that level, I can't help them. When you're in concentration and it's very pleasant and you feel this leaning and you can often feel, you know, as soon as you sit down again that you want to get right back to it, you know, that's an indication that you're leaning or that you don't want to let go of it, that you're reluctant to even acknowledge that its qualities fully, because you just want to indulge in it. You're not interested in what it feels like in there. You just want to kind of bathe in it. Well, those are some pretty good indications that you know, you're overstaying your welcome. Right. And when there is access concentration, which really is not that difficult. When concentration has reached a quality of access, which means that it's relatively steady in there, and so you can see what it is that you're looking at without leaving in 1 second for some duration, that's sufficient. That's sufficient one-pointedness now to move out of it. That's sufficient. Yes. Okay.
Not that I want to explore it. I'm curious about it.
Yes.
It's because I've been exploring that door for a long time, you can always find the pain in a situation. What if you can't? You know, you're just in a situation, the pain's not there, but you're making the positive story going in your mind.
Well, the question is exploring the pain door. Sometimes you can touch the pain, sometimes you can't. Sometimes the thoughts are too numerous to be actually be able to. But you know that there's something going on? Is that, you know there's something going on, but you can't get at it?
Oh, I mean, it's like the door you've been before. You know the pain's a lot less severe.
Right.
It's milder. But in order to open the door, you have to go back and experience the pain more deeply. That's what I'm confused about. Because the more times you go to the pain door, the easier it is. You know, so you get addicted to going to the pain door.
Yeah, okay, but you ask yourself a question about what you believe is there. You see, without a specific example, it's hard for me to move with any depth. But let's say that it was the pain. It was pain of around some
loss,
like bereavement.
Yeah.
Okay. So so you're with loss. Now there's a couple of things going on. One is the mind is going to make a lot of things about loss. It's going to say, I can't survive without this person. This person was, you know, I. And when those questions come up, which are the real root of the pain, it's not the sense of loss so much. It's what the hopelessness that's associated with the loss that's the real root of the suffering. You ask yourself, is this true? Is it true? Gently. I'm not going to be able to survive without this person. Oh, God, my heart hurts so bad. I just can't. Is this true? Is that true? You see, instead of getting carried away with the thought, which is the pain, reel in the truth of it. Is this true that I can't survive? I can't survive. I'm surviving right now. Do I miss the person? Of course I do. I miss the person. But keep the thoughts within a parameter of sanity, because when they are, then the stability of mind follows suit with that sanity. When it gets to the insane, in which it takes the emotion and runs crazy in terms of its depiction of what that emotion will eventually mean to your life, then there's no range of stability in your mind at all. So being able to bring yourself back into sane thinking, and then just into the feeling of the emotion, and just into the sacredness of that feeling, really, is all a part of the journey towards a stabilizing consciousness. Yes.
What's the relationship, I guess, between samadhi and opening the heart?
What's the relationship between samadhi and opening the heart? I love these kind of questions. Right? Say, opening the heart's way out there in samadhi. How am I going to answer this? Okay. So, listen to this. A stable mind is an open heart. Because what keeps the mind closed is the confiscation, how thoughts confiscate that opening through taking you off into a world of concepts. If we give up the world of concept and find ourselves intimately affected by life and yet able to hold that life in a stable relationship, you'll find you also have a capacity to care and to be kind, because you'll be connected. And those qualities of heart arise when there is a sense of connection. So just notice it in yourself. The quieter you are, the more connected you are. The less chaotic it is in here, the more you have access to affection, to genuine caring, to feeling compassion when you feel pain. When you see pain, you feel the hurt. You feel compassionate to it. And that happens as the mind quiets and becomes less noisy. Okay? But if you're busy staring at one thing like your breath, You're never going, and your mind's quiet, which it can also happen when you're on one object, but you're never going to open enough up so that those qualities of the heart can be seen or nurtured. Yes.
You piqued my curiosity when you were answering Dave's question earlier about when you were talking about loss. You said explore the sacredness of the feeling.
Yes.
The
question is just exploring the sacredness of the feeling. This takes you out there a little far, so I apologize to those of you who don't want to travel there, but. You see, loss has a spiritual function. And I don't mean this in any way to be upsetting to people who have had loss. So believe me, I know grief intimately, in hospice and in personal. But it has a spiritual function. Unless the universe takes something away from you, how do you know? How can you know that you can survive without it? How can you know that you can that your aliveness can be accessed except through without seeing the absence of this dependency? How do you know? You see, you might think that the whole sense of your health, your wealth, your happiness is dependent upon this person, and suddenly that person is not there anymore. What the universe is trying to show you in terms of its sacredness, I feel, is that none of those things was dependent upon anything. That those are inherent. Your ability to love was not dependent upon your loved object. But we say that, don't we? We say, oh, I love you, and then we clutch on to that person we love to stay close to the fact that we know love is in ourselves. But without that person, what happens to my love? The love is still there. But we have to know that by having the person taken away. You see? So there's a spiritual function in terms of your own autonomy, your own sacredness, your own godliness that needs to be shown to you through, that can be shown to you through loss and through very little else. Do you get a sense of what I'm saying? Because we lean on the forms of the world for what we think is what life is about. And until those forms are taken away and we see some different dimension of ourselves that maintains and remains, without that, nothing has happened to my love. Just as something has happened to the object of my love. If you think about the person you've lost, and still the love is there. It's just the person isn't there as much. Nothing's happened to the love. And so you begin to see that the forms of the world and dependency upon them really rob us of a deeper sense of independence that has to come for us to take our proper place in things and to know the sacred within us. Okay, I think that'll be the last question.